Languages, specifications. So how do we know if a program is correct? Any program without a specification is by definition correct because, well, you don't know what it's doing. So you need to know the intent of a program before you can say that it is correct. Right? You need to have some way of specifying what the intent of a program is. And that requires a specification. So now we need to ensure, to allow a program to be proven correct, you need a specification and an implementation. Right? So how do we specify such a specification for a programming language? That's the topic of today. So the ideas here are, for example, model-based development. A model is sort of an abstract implementation, and then you have the actual implementation somewhere in the background. So for example, you have some sort of domain-specific language for some problem domain, and then you have a C, C++ implementation somewhere else. What is currently state-of-the-art is programming something in a model, and then leave some black boxes in the model for the actual implementation, so the implementation can be generated from the model, instead of having a completely separate model and a completely separate implementation. You somehow try and push everything into this model. Another way is doing sort of refinement-based development of your application. So you start with a simple prototype with lots of details left out, and then you slowly refine that prototype to get an implementation. This prototype that you started out with is effectively the model, right? So with prototype-based languages, you usually create a sort of skeleton, and then you refine that skeleton by gluing things on this skeleton until the program has the functionality that you required. So the general idea in either way is to have two languages. One language for specifying stuff, what the intent of a program is, and another language for doing the implementation. And the differences in between these approaches is in how close these two languages are, how closely are they integrated. Right, so does a specification then communicate its intent with the implementation? Somehow you need to be able to map the implementation with the specification. So you need to have some way of mapping these two languages together. So for example, you can do this via variables. So you have a model of your application, and there you have a variable, number or temperature, and in your implementation you have the same variable, temperature. And you have a mapping saying that this temperature variable there is the same variable intended in the implementation, also called temperature. And so you have some sort of mapping between variables in mapping in implementation and model, and then you can say that this should be the same as that over there. Right? So the hope is that the specification can then be automatically verified because it's a very high level. So it's a specification. It leaves out all the details that make automatic verification theorem proving hard to do. So model is simple and therefore verifiable. You cannot automatically verify, for example, some low-level C code. That is almost impossible to do. But if you leave out all the details, then the program becomes so small that it is verifiable again. So Coq, for example, is a language for proving things correct. It's a proof assistant. It is not really a proof checker. It's a proof assistant. So you write your theorems, your axioms, your facts inside of this Coq language, and then you say, Coq, please prove it to me. Prove that it is consistent with each other, or internally consistent. And then Coq will try and apply rules and theorems to see if it can be proven. If not, then it asks the programmer of this Coq language to give it more facts to be able to continue proving things. So ideally in Coq, you have a large library of ways of proving things, and you invoke that library to prove your specification correct or internally consistent. Right. A little bit about Coq. So you have propositions, you have sets, mathematical sets, And you have abstract data types. An abstract data type is just as an ADT as we know it, as we've seen it before, where I cannot look into the internals of an ADT. So tau over E is then the type of some expression, right? So tau of 3 is an integer, right? So the type of, we saw it before. So E of tau of E is true false if something is inside of that category, inside of a member of that type. So with check E, we can then ask a type of an expression. Right, so if you say, what is the type of some addition, then you know, it's that value, and that is a natural value, so a natural integer. Right, what is the type of a natural integer? That's a set of number, Yeah, numbers are a set, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Together, that forms a set of all possible numbers. What's the type of a set? Yeah, a set is a type. Right? And then what is the type of a type? We cannot inspect, but a type is a type. We cannot, it's atomic, it cannot look into that further. What's the type of O? There's no zero. There's only O, and there's a successor of O, and the successor of the successor of O for creating natural numbers. Right? There are functions and operators, as they have in normal programming languages. So check, what is the type of greater than? Greater than is a function that takes two natural numbers and returns a proposition. A proposition is either true or false, right? So, what is the type of equality? So when are things equal? Well, what is the function there? It's a polymorphic function, taking a type and another type, right? So two arguments of the same type, and it returns a Boolean. Where I don't really care about what the type of the argument is, right? We don't care if it's an equality over natural number, two natural numbers, or equality over two propositions, or equality over two other things. So it's a polymorphic function taking whatever type of argument. So for all possible types of arguments, two arguments should be given, and it should return a proposition for true or false. Right, so a little bit of quok code. Right? It's not really code, it's a programming language, but more a proof, a language for proving things about specifications. So declare a natural number n, you have an hypothesis that this declares a function named positive n, and it returns a proposition, true or false, if that number is greater than zero. Right? And then we can check what is the type of this function. It's a function pos n returns n, a Boolean n bigger zero, right? So that's what we expect. Check what is the greater, what is the type of greater than n zero. So if you invoke it, that delivers a Boolean, so a proposition. Right, some definitions, right? So we declare a function for positive n, and then we define that the number 1 is the successor of O, 2 is the successor of 1, 3 is the successor of 2, right? And then times 2 is then plus 4 two numbers, and plus is then another hypothesis. So we have universal qualification, so we can operate on predicates. So for all variables of a given type, or is there an element inside of this set where something holds true? All right, so given a definition, for all numbers m bigger of type natural number, it should be that m is bigger than zero. And then we can do a check for all positive to check if its type is matchable. All right. So here we have another definition for add n to a given number, and then we add n to an n. So n is a global variable. So now you have specifications with functions and global variables and functions for proving things in that specification. Let's try and use that. Let's create a simple proof in Coq. So A arrow B means A implies B. A arrow B arrow C means if A holds, then B holds, and then if they both hold, then C should hold as well. Right? So if A implies B and that implies C, then in turn, if A implies B, then we can assume that when A holds, C holds as well. Right? So how do we prove that this is a correct formula? So how do we prove this using Coq? Right? This is some Coq session. Right? You start in Coq interpreter, and then you say, please introduce me a number of variables, A, B, C, of type Boolean, or proposition in logic terms. Then we introduce a goal. I want to prove that this formula holds. So I introduce a new goal, a goal for proving something. When I type enter there, it defines me a number of subgoals. So A, B, and C are subgoals that I still have to prove before this goal can be proven. Then I type intros. Intro says, please introduce me all the left-hand sides of all the implications as things still to be proven. So this introduces me that part and that part as and that part, because they are all left-hand sides of implications, as sub-goals to prove the bigger goal. Right? And I apply H is here, right? I can apply this this implication, which says to prove this entire goal, I can assume A. When I assume A, this whole formula can be implied, and then I have a new subgoal of B, right? I have a new subgoal and apply H1 because H1 has B as its target, so I can assume A again. Apply H1 and then B is the new goal. Apply H0, so H0 is that guy over here, right? So I assume that guy, and to prove, if I assume that, then that should be a new goal. That's a new goal. I can apply H1. I need to prove that guy. I need to prove A. H1 is assume A. So I need to prove A that A holds. A is already in my assumption set. Therefore, I have proven that this formula holds. So what have I done here? I have created a number of apply, and introduce, and goal. And in the end, I've proven something. This is a recipe. So now I have a recipe for proving a given formula. And a recipe for proving things is a program. So now I have programs for proving things. Right? This is the way to think about this. I can now create programs that prove things. If a given specification holds, right? So given a specification, I can now write programs to prove if that specification is internally consistent. Right. So at all times in this recipe that I just did, this run through, there's only one goal available. So it's unambiguous what I need to do next. Right? There's no choice in what to do next. If there is a choice, then it's given a proof tree, right? I don't know if I need to prove this goal first or that sub-goal next or that sub-goal next. In that case, there's a proof tree and I need to try all possible permutations of things to see if there is a way of proving something, right? So a program in such a proof language is non-deterministic. I need to try all possible ways of proving things to see if some of these paths lead to success. Right? So assumption is applying a rule if there's no other rule to be applied. That's proof composition, right? So I can have programs, right, which prove things. And if I now have a goal, a complex goal for something that I need to prove correct, right, then I have I can prove that bigger sub goal by applying little programs one at a time. I have something complex that I want to prove true. First, I run a little program, a little proof that gives me a few answers. Then I run some other programs or recipes or proof recipes and gives me more results. And in the end, I have a complete proof. So I can run sub-programs or sub-proofs to create bigger proofs. Right? So given a recipe of a proof, and can follow that with another recipe for a proof to get a better. A subprogram for assumptions, for introducing all my assumptions, and then apply something, and then my assumption. So this whole thing is a program, right? A small program for proving this goal to be true, this logic program. Right. So this whole program, I can this sequence of steps to prove something, I can push that into a function that I can later invoke. So a lemma is, in logic terms, a function. So this lemma introduces a function given a goal and how to solve that to prove that thing correct. Right? So now I can name a proof with, I can give a name to a proof so I can later easily invoke it. Right? So just like a normal programming language, you can now give names to proofs and create libraries of proofs for later easy invocation. Right? So this is now, I've created my simple function with some formula that I want to prove, and then I say auto, and auto means just search in the library for anything that matches and try it. So auto here will look into the library of existing lemmas or existing functions and see that there is a function that accepts this goal as its argument, and then run the code of this lemma, and then see, it's provable, and it returns success and finish. So something else. So disjunction is commutative. So A or B is the same as B or A, and B and A is the same as B, A and B. Right? So it's commutative operations. So how do you prove that a commutative operation is correct? So now in programming languages terms, I have a specification of something, of a function, and I need to know that this function is correct, that this does what it's supposed to do. So I need to prove that the specification holds to my implementation. And if in my specification I wrote A or B, and in my implementation I wrote B or A, these things are equal. So I need to be able to prove such a mapping. That is where something like this comes into play. So I create another section. I have a lemma, sort of function that I define a function for proving that something is commutatively correct. And then the code of this function is intros, eliminate, split, apply, and apply. So given an invocation of such a lemma, right, I see A or B somewhere in my code, in my what I want to prove. I see A or B. I can apply this lemma, and it will automatically state this is the same as B or A, and can apply a tactic for proving such a thing then correct. So to run through this bit of code here, first do an intros. If I do an intros, then A or B is B or A. That means introduce A or B as subcalls. Huh? Then I can do an eliminate H. A or B holds, then B or A is then A. B and A is then the call, a subcall. Then I can apply a implication. So if A implies B, then it implies B or A. This is of course true, because if A implies B, then A must already hold. If that holds, then B must also hold, and B and A must be true. So I define that as a subcall, apply it, and I'm finished. Right? So this was a fairly simple thing to do. So in the exercises, you did a bit of prolog code for proving that somebody was the killer in a number of students, right? You had a number of students and a number of rules, right? So if somebody passed economics and not passed something else, then he did and he followed some other class, then he was the killer, right? That was the exercise for prolog. That was a fair bit of code that you had to write. Let's look at how such a style of program is mapped towards Coq. So if you were to write that killer program in something like Coq, what did it look like? So we have a number of sets, again, and members of sets. So if somebody is Scottish and he wears red socks, everyone that wears a kilt but doesn't wear red socks, then something and something. There's a set of implications here. So I can have a section for what I want to prove. I define a number of variables. I create a number of hypotheses. And a function for defining how to solve a given problem, right? Finished, and then I check if there is a solution or a check for the types of things. So it's a very concise way of specifying such constraint problems. Is something a member of a set? That can be very quickly defined in something like Coq. So a lot simpler than, for example, that you did with prolog. So Coq has functions. There's also pattern matching, as we saw in something like Haskell or Miranda. So I define an inductive set where an inductive set is a set, of course, with starting with true and false and zero and so forth. You define a number of functions that allow you to operate on that set. Then you define a fixed point. A fixed point says I am either zero or I am some natural number followed by zero, right? I'm the successor of something else, and then it defines it recursively towards zero again. So can you find sets and recursively based on some zero point in that set? So you can algorithmically define sets. We saw the same thing with Haskell, for example. Okay, so now what? So how do we use all of this Coq stuff? So to prove that something is correct in a language, you program something in C or C++, or you want to prove that your language is somehow correct in form of completeness, then you port your program or your language specification towards Coq and then prove that somehow in Coq it is internally consistent. So Coq is a proof assistant. It is not a proof checker where everything is automatic. You import into Coq a sequence of lemmas and functions and hypotheses to prove that your program is correct. So Coq is a way of writing specifications. Okay, other ways of doing specifications. So Coq was very formal, right? You had to write lemmas and theorems and hypotheses. That was very abstract, and it's for somebody who is not a theoretician or somebody who is very into logic, then it'll be hard to do. Let's try and move these specifications closer towards Java and C and C++. So what are our options here? Either you write a specification inside of your code, inside of the middle of a function, and you write your specifications before as a precondition, and you have post conditions. Right? There are also, if you write object-oriented code, there are also object invariants. Let's say if inside of this object there are two fields, then this second field should be twice as big as this first field. Right? So you have field invariants, so inside of a single object, this field is always bigger than that field over there. There are also inter-object invariants, where it says, if I have a list object, and this list has a count field, then the number of list nodes should be equal to this count field. Right? That is something harder to express. So now you're stating constraints over the object graph. Right? So you have object invariants over the object graph and constraints inside of a single object over its object fields. So this is a inter-object field constraint. Right? It says if I have a field A and a field B, then I have a constraint that B should be twice as big as A. Hmm? The trick is then, what languages do this stuff? What languages do these pre and post and object constraints and so forth? So Euclid is an earlier language, more Pascal-like, where we are forced, either by the compiler or by the programmer, to write enough asserts so that the program stays correct. So if the compiler cannot prove that an assert is always true, then it will give a compile time error. In Java, if you write an assert statement, it'll be triggered at runtime. So at runtime, an assert is always checked to see if it is true. If it's not true, then it'll throw an exception in Java. Here, the assert is for the compiler. The compiler analyzes these assert statements to see if it is true, always. It's more secure than Java. Right, so the compiler and the programmer can add asserts to the code. So here's a bit of Euclid code. First thing that you notice here is that for every procedure, you have to explicitly state what is used by that function, by the procedure. So here, I have a get counter function, and then imports the counter free and the counters and the number of counters variables. Why are they doing this? In Euclid, it is not allowed to have aliasing. So what I want is no aliasing. So there are references or variables that are passed by reference in Euclid. This means that a variable can have multiple pointers pointing to it. And if there are multiple pointers to the same variable, then it is not always clear what pointer goes to where. Right? That makes it hard to analyze for the programmer to see if that program is correct. So what we want to do is just eliminate all the aliases and ensure that the program is easy to understand. Right? So we want to eliminate double pointers to the same variable. Right? Aliasing, we want to remove aliasing. And how do we ensure that? The next thing is post conditions after executing get counter, the counter should not be free and the number of counters should be zero afterward. So that is a fairly complex post condition to analyze still. Here I have a precondition as well, right? Before freeing a counter, the counter should not be freed already. Right? So these pre and post conditions can become fairly involved, even for something that is compiler supported. So there are value ranges. So values have ranges. So here I is valid from 0 to 50 and z from 10 to 20. And now we want to prove that variable can never be out of its range. This is important for many things. For example, many attacks for security attacks happen because a variable goes out of range in some way. Right? And we want to prove that that thing never happens at runtime, and therefore the program is always correct. So here we have an array, and this array can be indexed by I. Or by Z, and we want to prove that thing is always correct. That never you have an index out of bounds. index out of bounds does not throw an exception here. It should be at compile time intercepted that an out of bounds can never occur. So in Java, if you index an array out of its bounds, you get an array out of bounds exception. Right? Many languages, such as C or C++, just don't do this runtime checking, and you just overwrite some memory somewhere. That is a security attack. So here we want to, at compile time, eliminate that and never have an exception. So here the compiler has to prove the values of things inside of a loop. So here the compiler inserts this assert for, here index A with I plus 1, so it inserts an assert. I plus 1 must be smaller or equal 50. That is automatically inserted here, and then a proof checker for Euclid will go over the code and prove that none of these asserts will ever be violated. So aliasing was not allowed. So where does aliasing occur in a Pascal-like program? So Pascal had these var parameters. So if something is called var, then it was called by reference. Without this var keyword, it's called by copy. So this passed by copy without var, passed by a reference with var. So x is actually a pointer to this x over there. So foo is as a reference to it, x is a reference to it. So is there a potential alias here? No, not really, right? Need to make it more complex. Here, foo is passed counter free 3, and counter free 3 is global array, and it's passed a reference to the third element, so x will point to the third element, and now we have an alias, because at the same time in that program, where I'm accessing x equals 4, it is at the same time is this array live as well. So now we have at the same time in the program multiple ways of accessing the same variable. And now we have an alias, and that is something that we want to forbid. So for program understanding, we want only one way of accessing a variable to be possible at the same time. All right, so this counter free 3 element 3 is an alias to x there. That is something that we don't want to do. So, SpecSharp. So Euclid is not the only language out there with specification. SpecSharp is in Microsoft's attempt, which is fairly similar to what Euclid is intended for doing, but more modern. There's objects, it's more C-like. They have non-null types, pre and post conditions, and we also add object invariants. Frame conditions, modification sets, so what are those? Those are the sets of variables that you are allowed to change. In Euclid, those were these import statements, right? In Euclid, you wrote import from somewhere else these sets of global variables. And you are only allowed to modify whatever you've imported. Those are effectively your frame conditions. The same as with Euclid, there's a proof checker that goes over your pre-conditions, your post-conditions, and show that these things are always kept. Right. So Euclid was a fairly old system where there was not enough memory there to try all possible permutations of something. And with C or with SpecSharp is fairly recent, a few years old, they're still under active development, where there's gigabytes of memory and you can run all possible permutations of something to prove that something is never false. Non-null types, why are those there? Well, you need to, many sources of errors in Java programs is because of null pointer exceptions. Everybody here will have seen a null pointer exception. So we need to prove that a null pointer can never occur. Well, you can either prove that something never occurs, or you can make sure from the start that it never occurs. So if you change the language so that null pointers are impossible to write or create, so there's no null, if there's no null, you can never have a null pointer exception. So this is the idea here. If you write your exclamation mark, it says this pointer can never be null. So you can never say d equals zero, d equals null. that assignment is illegal. So you can never assign null to a non-nullable variable. So null pointers are by definition not possible. You can also not assign a non-null nullable variable to a non-nullable variable. So you can never say data x equals null and then d equals null, because now you're trying to assign something that is nullable to something that is not nullable. Right? So the type system here ensures that null pointer exceptions can never occur. So invariance. Some spec sharp. Look here, we have the exclamation mark again, so this array can never be null. And then we have an invariant that this array has the same length as this other array. The problem is, we don't assign both arrays at the same time. We don't have a parallel assignment. You first need to initialize students and then initialize absent. But in between these two assignments, for a very short time, between these two assignments, this invariant will be violated, right? Because between these two assignments, one of these things will be internally null, and therefore null equals not equals the new length. That is why they have this expose here. Inside of this expose, it is for a short time these invariants not guaranteed. Right, so whenever you see an invariant that can be for a short time be violated, you as the programmer need to say that this is an unsafe region. In this region, an invariant can be briefly broken. And so you as the programmer need to say when what holds. And you shouldn't write main, expose everything, and then do your code. Right? That's not the plan. Okay, JML. Let's move a little bit towards Java, right? Some way from C sharp. Java does not have ways of by default adding pre and post conditions. So we need another language for specifying those, so like a preprocessor. So here we add an invariant as an annotation over a given field or a given array for the length of this array should be always bigger than zero. So it always be something in that array, room for something in that array. And if after we initialize the class, then this array should be assigned to that array. Notice here that the code that we are writing here exactly mirrors the specification. Do we really need to write a specification here? Or cannot the specification be inferred from the code? Can I not write a preprocessor that looks at the code, extracts the specification, and be done with it? This is a trend. So pre and post conditions for JML, it's the same idea again. So we have there's one line of code for initializing or allocating a new array. And then that function requires that the argument that the array should be allocated with some elements in it. It should be, this elements field will be modified. And after the functions run, then the size of the new array is n. Right? So that requires a fair bit of specification for only one line of code. Okay. We need some way of specifying things over sets and lists and maps and hash tables and so on. That requires predicates. So you have a predicate for all elements in a set, this should hold. There should be an element in the set where something holds. And X is the minimum of whatever is in the set, right? And so forth. So you need to have some form of formulas that you can use in your specification of a function to make statements over what is going on inside of that function. Okay, something more complex. Let's say you have a stack and want to be able to push elements on a stack and pop elements from the stack. To push things on a stack, what do we need? we need an array of elements, and we need the size of the stack, that is the current size, so we have an invariant that is for that field. And then we need to be able to state that for all elements that are currently in the stack, that that element should be not null. Right? So if you have a stack, then no element in that stack that we've pushed should be null. So we should not push a null pointer onto the stack. Let's look at our push method. We want to push an element on the stack. So the code is just is extremely simple. Right? We write to the array for our current top of the stack, and then we increment the top of the stack. But there is this whole range of specification that we then need to add. We first need to say that our class is still internally consistent, right? The size is matches that the maximum size of our stack, so we don't go out of bounds. We're going to write to element to the stack and to the size, and after our size has been our push has been executed, the size should be over the old size of the stack. Right? And then redundantly for all elements in the stack, somewhere on the stack, the old element should still exist. We should not have removed something from the stack. And then look at the code here. What have we done? What have we done? You have two statements here versus such a huge specification. This is something going in the wrong direction, perhaps. But if you need to prove that your program is absolutely correct, and it will never throw a null pointer exception and never an out of bounds exception, then you need all of this stuff. The same for a pop. A pop is likewise complex, but I need to say that after you've popped something from a stack, that everything still not popped is still on the stack, and nothing is null on the stack, and so forth. So a question to you guys. What is more probable? That you've made a mistake in the specification or a mistake in the code? I can already tell you that, for example, the push was wrong. The specification for push was incomplete. What have I missed in this specification for push? Anybody? I've not specified that you cannot push a null pointer onto the stack. So it's even incomplete. But at the pop, I still say that somewhere in the stack there should not be a null pointer. There's somewhere that I've stated. So I can push a null pointer onto the stack. That is something that you probably don't want. Just looking at the top of the stack, right? So you need to, the stack must not be empty. They don't assign to anything, and the result should be the top of the stack. Now, look at this. This is where I'm really proud of, that I got this correct. So to extract the minimum of a stack, you need to look at all the elements of the stack, and there should be no duplicates in the stack, and it should be the whatever you've removed from the stack should be the minimum element, and that should not be present after you've extracted the element. So that was a lot of work, but the code of extract minimum is one loop with give an element and removing it afterwards. So this is the amount of work in extract minimum is 5 lines of code. So what can we do with these annotations, right? We've added our sweat and our effort into adding these specifications. How can we use these as specifications? So given these specifications, we can automatically generate unit tests. That is already a good gain. Right? We can automatically generate tests for functions to say that nobody broke something. It's still not until testing is not enough for insurance, right? If you just generate 5 or 6 tests, that will not suffice for proving something correct. For proving something correct, you need more than just tests. You need an actual theorem prover, where all of these specifications are added to a theorem prover, and the theorem prover then proves A, that the specification is internally consistent, So one specification does not contradict another specification. That can, for example, happen when you have a function with a precondition. And in that function, you call another function that also has a precondition, and this precondition excludes the precondition of the callee. So if the caller and the callee both have specifications, and these specifications contradict, right? For example, here you have a precondition, variable is bigger than 100. And in the callee, you have a function, a specification to say variable smaller than zero, then these things contradict. The variable cannot be smaller zero and bigger than 100 at the same time. So the specification of a caller and a callee should not contradict, and that is something that a theorem prover can extract. So aliasing. In Euclid, we had a lot of effort in removing aliasing. What is the use of removing aliasing from our specifications, so that our specification can say that there is no aliasing? So here we have a class counter, and into that counter we add an element from another counter. Right? So we have a counter, and we want to add the value of that counter to ourselves. And then we have a specification that says I can assign to this value, and the value should be, the new value should be old value plus the value of y counter, and afterward y value should not be changed. So y is read only. That's what I wanted to say there. Is this correct? It's tricky. I need to add some more. I should at least require that I'm not adding me to myself, right? So I should not add this point add to this. I should not write something like this. So I need to be able to remove aliasing, because that is probably wrong behavior. The ability to think of all possible conditions that something can be called, right? That is for a human almost impossible to make sure that a specification is complete. Because you need to think of all possible possibilities, and that is not something that a human cannot really do. Okay, here I have an if statement. If something, then do something else, with an else. So this requires that if something holds, then something happens, and when that other condition holds, then something else happens. So now I'm modeling my code verbatim in my specification, to ensure that my specification does exactly that what my method already is doing. But I need to do this to be complete. Without this, I'm overly generalizing my specification. I can rewrite this specification towards saying a val bigger than zero or val bigger than one at the end, right? So I can overgeneralize my specification and then make my specification smaller but less exact. Or I can choose to make my specifications exact and remove a lot more errors from my program, but at the expense of making my specifications more complex and more error prone. So I can now choose. Do I make my specifications more precise and error prone and allow my implementation errors to be found? Or do I make my specifications simpler with the possibility of not finding all the errors in my implementation? So in either case, you don't find all the other errors in your implementation. That's a little tricky. The same for exceptions, right? I have a function foo that can, for example, throw an exception. What do I do with these exceptions in my specification? Ideally, I manage these exceptions in my specification as well. So for example, here I have a function foo, throws an exception of some type, and in my specification, a specification should model what the implementation is doing. I need to model these exceptions as well. So I stated when something occurs, some condition holds, then it signals some exception. And for the exception, I have a pre and post condition as well, potentially. Right? For after my exception has been thrown, then the state of my program is unchanged, or if this exception is thrown, then this variable in my class is potentially changed, my object is changed. So I should state, if exception is thrown, then this that object before the exception has that state, or after that exception that state. Okay. Java does not only have classes and objects, but also has interfaces for writing sort of ADTs. So I have an interface gendered with is female, and I want pure semantics. Pure means functional, right? So it's a pure functional semantics. It does not change any state. So now I have an interface, and I implement that interface somewhere else. Pure functional method, I can add some more specifications, and then the compiler should ensure that the implementer of this interface upholds these specifications. So whenever I implement gendered, the isFemale method should not be somehow changing some state to ensure that functional interfaces are still there in functional form in the implementation. So here I implement this interface, and here we have this female method again. Right. Should even match that it's gendered and assignable, because I change gender. I assign to a meta field. What is the meta field again? So this is for, this is a typo, so it'd be gen, assignable gen. And assign a search gen equals. So this is a typo in the slides. Okay, some remarks. So we saw that these complications, these specifications can become fairly complex and involved and effectively mirror your implementation to allow the specification to be exact, as exact as possible. There are potential interface problems, right? If in the base class you have a specification of a method, and you have a derived class that overrides the method from your base class, then that derived method that overrides the base methods, the base method should make the inherit the specification as well, right? If you override the method from a base class, you override the specification as well, right? And you can only make that specification more exact for that newer implementation. There's no concurrency control, there's no parallel, right? So all of this Java modeling language stuff did not take parallelism into account. It is also hard, right? How do you specify that when this runs in parallel to that, then this invariant should still hold at all cases? So we need to have some way of specifying invariants that hold over multiple threads. Right? And that is where it becomes a little more tricky, and that is where most research is currently at, for specifying constraints over multiple threads. That is research. OCL. In JML, you wrote your specifications directly in the source code. That has some advantages, right? If you change your code, it's easy to also change your specification, because it's just above each other, right? The specification is just above the implementation. So they're close by, you can easily change one with the other. On the other hand, it clutters your code, right? Because you have two source codes in one file, effectively. So it makes sense to have a separate specification and implementation file, so they are not cluttered by each other. And somebody else can write the specification, and you only have to implement that specification somehow. So it makes sense to have some sort of separation of concerns, creating separate files. So OCL. In OCL, you specify contexts to allow a OCL file to reference locations in an implementation file. So here are some examples. I have some Java code without the annotations. Those are now external. Right? And in this external data, I say, in context of the student class, there is an invariant that self age is bigger than 18. All students would be older than 18, right? Or in context of the student class, the advisor should be older than 18 as well. And for all students S, all the students should be younger than 64. It's maybe discriminatory by now, but I guess. Right? How involved can we make these external specifications? So first thing that we have is pre and post conditions. So in the context of the method income in class person, we have an integer where if underage, then something else. So I can write method invocations and refer to methods in the original code. You can even define local variables in these constraints. So constraints are now a separate language, right? In JML, they were just annotations, and here they are more complete functions that you write that should mirror the implementation. Right? So OCL, does this JML has no concept of concurrency control, so there's no parallelism there. There are no constructs to limit the inheritance tree, so you cannot write a constraint. Please do not inherit from this class in your code. And whenever, or if you inherit from this class, then this method should be overwritten. Right? Those are constraints as well, and we are writing object constraint language, so we should be able to constrain what happens with my objects and what happens with my methods in those objects. There's limited support for polymorphism, so you can state that an inheritor from this class should always have the invariant that this field should be bigger than 10. Some examples for NewSMV. NewSMV is a synchronous language. Synchronous means, or reactive language, I don't want to name it. It says things should be run in parallel and should be triggered on events. So here I have a function. So here we have a 3-bit word, another 3-bit word. We assign it with both variables with 0 initially. And then the next value of val1 is val1 plus 1. And these things then run in parallel, concurrently. So another step. So we have a state machine, right? So a state machine with a Boolean and a state ready or busy. Initially we are ready, and otherwise the next value of state is either if state is ready and a request is true, then we go to state busy and one. Otherwise we are in state one or default and we go to ready and busy. So what does this bring us? This brings NewSMV as a simple language for writing specifications again. So you write your code somewhere in Java, C, something, and then you write NewSMV code at a high level model what your program should be doing. For example, with state machines and explicit parallelism. So now we can model parallelism in some way. This is something that the older other languages missed. You could not write parallel in your code. NewSMV has error and problems in other things, but still. So here I try and run my code. I have the state machine of the last slide. I say go, and I say, and then the state machine starts running, and it's a pick state. And it says, there are a number of states available. Which one do you want to run? I start running it, and so forth. I can also say simulate it, and then start running with whatever transitions in your state machine supply. So now I have runnable specifications in NewSMV. So executable specifications, that is something fairly new as well for a few years, where a specification in JML or OCL are not runnable, right? There are pre and post conditions towards your functions. I cannot run a precondition. I cannot run a post condition. In a NewSMV, the idea here is a step towards runnable specifications, where your specification is precise enough that I can run my specification. I don't really need an implementation. I can run a specification that runs a little bit in some abstract way. So executable specifications. So what is an executable specification? Is that just not a program? Okay, some other NewSMV. I have a counter, a bitwise counter. So new SMV is more suited towards low modeling of low-level problems. So I have a, what is a binary counter? For a binary counter, I have values, an array of values, and carries. All right, so for a counter, I have bits, which I can add with booleans, right? So I have a boolean in, and there comes a boolean carry out, and there's a value coming out. So it's an output, a carry, and an input. This is one state for one instance of our counter cell. So this is our counter cell. And that can be piped towards the next counter cell as its input. And it has some output, and it has some value coming out. So I can chain these towards an array, and so an array of counter cells then brings us a integer counter. The nice thing about new SMV, the statement ordering doesn't matter because all of these statements run in parallel anyways. So next counter out and next to value can be swapped, right? So you can swap these regardless, doesn't matter. So parallelism is first in our language. So you have to explicitly refer to the old and to the new values to allow parallel execution. All right, so define declares a name for an expression so we can define simple functions. We have type inference, so you don't have to write this function returns an integer. This type of a function is then automatically extracted. For example, here carry out is defined by value and carry in. So you define a sort of output variable, and the same as on a function. And then you can start a number of counters running in parallel where one counter takes its input from another counter. Same for inverters, right? You want to invert a number of bits to get new bits. So you define a number of gates with a number of input gates and a number of output gates, and these things run then in parallel and give return values. And the scheduler then picks non-deterministically which of these three should then be run next. So you have parallel processes for a more coarse-grained parallelism, where you can say, I want fair running that all the processes that I generate here, so I have three independent processes running in parallel in the background, then do bitwise inversion. Okay. Next step for specification is saying, in the future, something should hold. Or from now on, something should hold. Or as long as this condition holds, some other condition should hold as well. Or as after this condition evaluates the true, then this condition should hold. Right? So reasoning over time. Right? So after some time, this should hold. After, before that time, this should hold, and so forth. So those are linear time logics, where you assume a linear sequence of time steps, and every time step then has some condition that holds, or after some condition, some time holds. So you have a linear sequence of time units where you can specify constraints on time. CTL is for parallel. So time is branching, or time is sequential. Here is sequential code, here is parallel code. In CTL, you say, for every possible future, some conditions should hold, right? Or there is a future where some condition will hold, right? That is CTL. For LTL, it's then linear time. So how do we use LTL and CTL in our specifications, for example, in new SMV? So we can compose formulas, so EX and AX and so forth can then be combined with other E's and A's and so forth. So EX says there is a, there will be a time where X, the condition X will hold. Or for all possible, for it is always true that from now on some condition holds, right? And so forth. So CTL and LTL can be used in specifications to make statements over time. This is Here's some more examples, right? So AXP, so proposition P holds in state S if there is a state S where there is a transition from S to S something else and P. Right, so we have a state machine. This guy is active, and I have a number of transitions. And here a condition X holds. X equals 3, for example. And here I can say there exists a state S in our state machine such that in state S X equals 3. So this is a LTL formula where you say that sometime in the future you will reach a state where in that state some condition holds. Right? You can also say something like this. For all S in our state machine, there should be a state such that X equals 3. Is this formula true or not? No, right? Because in this state I've not said that X equals 3. So this is not true. Not good. Right? And this is the same that you had for all the others. Right, so in LTL you say, is there a future where something holds? For CTL you can say, is there a future where such a condition holds? So is this a LTL or a CTL formula? This is a CTL formula. Right? You say, is there a future where you will go to a state where that? So, how do I use this LTL, for example, inside of our new SMV codes? You have a separate bit of specification at the end saying there is a future where some value will be 1, right? So I can say in the future something will hold in a given state in my program. So this is fairly nicely integrated. So I can say things about time and futures and possible futures. To check that these LTL formulas hold, you pass your code to the new SMV checker, and you say check me this specification, and it finds this LTL formula, and it then runs over all possible states in my diagram to see if at any place there is one of these LTL formulas that is never true. Right? It looks at, follows all possible states in my through my state machine to see if my LTL formula will never hold or will sometimes not hold. Okay, Promila. Promila is another specification language. It's more like C. It's based on C, but they removed a lot of the stuff that makes C difficult to analyze. So, for example, they removed function calls from C. So now you can only write main. And inside of that main, you can write loops. And if you want calls, then you must do macros. Instead of normal function calls, you can write macro calls. So you can never write recursive functions, right? Because recursive functions with macros is a little tricky. But you can use macros to simulate function calls a little bit. But you have local variables, global variables, and most importantly, you have parallelism. So in Promila, there is parallel code that you can model and prove that this parallel code is correct. So what do we have left in Promila? There are statements, limited function calls via these macros. You can inline some C code, some ordinary C code inside of your Promila specification, and while, switch, and if, and so forth. There's also communication channels. So instead of pure shared memory, communication can also use channels for communication between parallel processes, like you saw in Go or Salsa a little bit. So there's no function calls, you just have to write macros to simulate function calls a little bit. It works to some effect. Right. You have to be a little careful with the names of variables, otherwise these macros don't really work as well. But the effect is there. So here's a bit of parallel code. Now it's just one part of process. I have an init process that starts running the GCD function. And the GCD function has a multiple, as some sort of multi-if statement. If that holds, then go to that. If that holds, then do that. If that holds, then test if it holds. Right, you need to do something. Right, and this should deliver greatest common divisor. That's simple enough. This code is then transformed internally by this Promila thing into a state machine. So this code is translated into a state machine. This state machine is then checked for correctness. The same way as that new SMV is running. So looping is via do-od, so do loop. It's not much different than we know it from C. These things for colon is for defining steps, so atomic steps in your model. So do-od. So do step and another step. And the choice between running that or that is non-deterministic. So there are non-deterministic statements in our specification. The checker of a specification should then try all possible choices in our non-deterministic statements and non-deterministic choices to see that nothing bad ever happens. So a checker from a Promila program can do 5 times this guy and then 1 time that guy, or 3 times that guy and then 1 time that guy, and then see if it ever happens that something bad happens at runtime, at check time. So for example, a spin is then the interpreter for one of these spin programs, and then run this spin program and it generates added to or sub to non-deterministically. So it is add, sub 1 time and then a number of adds and then a few subs, because it non-deterministically chooses which one of these two to run. And if you run it long enough and you have asserts in your code to see that something is bad occurred, then it will crash sometime. So it is non-deterministic choice is used to examine the all possible states in your state space. Okay. So here we have an init, and I run a separate process hello that goes in the background and prints hello. This is an active process, so it runs as a new thread effectively. Right, so then runs this hello program in my spin interpreter, and it says, hello, I'm running for my other pit, and then I'm finished. And a tree process is created. Right, a little more complex with channels. Like in Google Go, we have channels for communicating between processes. So here I have a channel with two instances of message at most in this communication channel. And I have a sender, creates a message, and like in Occam, you say to channel with an exclamation mark for saying I want to write to that channel, and then pushes M in that channel. For the receiver, then like Occam, has a question mark for retrieving something from that channel and potentially blocking if the channel is currently empty. Then you can see that in this channel, that expected value has arrived. Right? We have a search for proving that something went correctly or not correctly. And then in it, we just run these two processes in parallel, in the new threads. Okay, so these assert statements are used by Promila to detect erroneous states in my state space. What Promila for the spin interpreter can also do is run all possible permutations. So there are possibilities where, for example, I have two threads running here, foo and zoo. Foo and zoo can run then in parallel. But every statement of each parallel task can be interleaved in different ways. Right? For example, here, I can run this statement first, and then that statement, and then that statement, and then that statement, or I can run both statements here, and then the statements of that guy, or that guy first, and then that guy first. Right? So there are a number of interleavings of possibilities of running one statement of one process and then the statements of another process. There are a number of interleavings of threads. That creates race conditions. And these race conditions are found by the spin interpreter. The spin interpreter will try all possible permutations of thread interleavings to see if never anything bad happens with any interleaving of threads. If it happens, then you are to write these atomic blocks to create mutual exclusion. Okay, that's it for today.